This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
Rahila. Firstly, I'd like to introduce you to Toll's Meadow, a small conservation area on the outskirts of the market town where I live and very often walk my eager cocker spaniel. We both enjoy it very much. I enjoy walking and reflecting, while Tissy, of course, loves sniffing. Such early morning sniffing, as dog walkers know, is the canine equivalent of reading the newspaper. A river runs through Toll's Meadow. Some people would call it a stream, especially at this point of its journey, but I haven't heard anyone in Wyndham refer to it as such. For us, it looms large, and this is rather like poems to their writer, of real value to us, even when they don't quite work or never come to fruition. They are part of a river, the inner and outer river, you could say, at the confluence of the two. I think you might find Toll's Meadow quite ordinary, a few acres, part wetland, part wooded, bordered by a cemetery on one side and a road into town on the other. But like a poem that yields more at each reading, it gradually enters the bloodstream. Perhaps you have somewhere near you, Rahila, which has gathered similar significance. A few weeks ago, when I was walking through the wooded strip, some lines of Hopkins came to me. Perhaps I said them aloud. Margaret, are you grieving over Golden Grove unleaving? For that moment, the trees did actually seem to be Golden Grove, the leaves with their short-lived flaring, the size of the wood. It was at first the detail of the leaves that brought the lines to mind, rather than the poem's overarching theme. Poetry, as it often is, don't you think, in the detail, rather than the grander scheme. I chanced upon the Hopkins poem when I was 16. I didn't at first understand unleaving and thought it was wholly to do with departure. I loved the haunting cadences and found the poem so memorable. It certainly spoke to me the other day. I've quite often heard readers or listeners talk about a poem in that way. It speaks to me, or it didn't speak to me. In the end, I think that's what a poem is. One person speaking to another, however unexpected or mysterious the voice. The French philosopher Simone Weil said, "A poem is beautiful to the precise degree in which the attention whilst it was being composed has been turned towards the inexpressible." Perhaps it is the inexpressible that speaks to you, and this in itself can be a solace. Hopkins' Spring and Fall, a consolation in a year of losses, particularly of father figures. My own father, Seamus Heaney, a poetry father, and then Nelson Mandela, a world father figure. Losses and endings. But you are near the beginning, Rahila, with the good fortune to be a young poet. In truth, I also feel like a beginner, and often think, what do I know about writing poetry? I think this particularly when I have just finished a series of poems, but I feel it in a general way. This is partly because there are so many poems to marvel at and look up to, past and present. I can even feel daunted by some of my own past poems, that they actually exist. But also, in a sense, it doesn't pay to be too knowing. To have written a poem in one way, and then to try and do the same again, or even something similar, can lead to shipwreck, to self-parody. As Rilke wrote of the creative person, "He must always remain unconscious, unsuspecting of his best virtues, if he would not rob them of their ingenuousness and their untouchedness." Ideally, there is always that plunge into the unknown. Beginner's freshness, or something that feels like it, is the most valuable quality of all. Toll's Meadow, a loved place. How important is place to poetry? I haven't always lived in rural Norfolk. I was born, as you may know, in Pakistan, and my birthplace has been important to my poems. What's been compelling about Pakistan is that for so many years I had no actual memories of it. I came to Britain when I was a few months old and only returned as an adult. For a long time, Pakistan was a fantasy, fed by family stories, extraordinary gifts, letters, news items. A difficult country, most would say. Recently, the author Fatima Bhutto of the Bhutto dynasty has called it a harsh country, an unfair country. But, she says, it produces women with extraordinary spirit. Also recently, I was delighted to read that the late Doris Lessing was struck, as I was, by the beauty of the country. Pakistan, in all its strife and complexity, and so many of its people, like the members of my family, just trying to get on with their daily lives. Until fairly recently, I lived in London, as you do, and felt that I drew on its multiplicity and its energies, even if I didn't write directly inspired by it. I value that experience of the city and hope that in some way it will always be with me. 20 years ago, when my first poems were published, poetry that reflected the cultural range of those living in Britain was very badly represented, in the mainstream at least. Thankfully, this is changing, slowly but surely. And there's not the expectation that we write on culture-specific themes, although we may wish to. There's less of the tendency to place in rigid boxes writers with their roots obviously elsewhere. How much do we really know of our cultures and hinterlands? Surely to gain such knowledge will always be of value. The main thing, though, is the quality of the poems. When it comes to a sense of home, we can make it, if we wish, in poetry itself. The poet Elizabeth Jennings wrote, "Oh, but there is a joy that I would speak. I have a dream and turn it to a song. It is the only home that I can make. Its doors are open to the careful young." When you take a dog for a walk, as I regularly do, you're not quite alone, and yet it is a kind of solitude. You are certainly free to think your own thoughts, or just to be. Rilke found time alone vital, nourishing. I suppose all poets do. He wrote to the young sculptor, Clara Westhoff, "I already feel my solitude again a little, and suspect that it will deny me nothing if I hearken to it with new strength." For Rilke, poems themselves can be lonely. "Of an infinite loneliness, and with nothing so little to be reached as with criticism, only love can grasp and hold and be just towards them." Poetry is play as much as solemnity, serious play. The psychoanalyst Winnicott introduced the idea of the third area, the area where we are more ourselves, a place of safety and of stimulus where, originally, the infant could play in that space created between mother and baby. In the case of poetry, we could say that there is also some transformation of the self, allowed by the presence of the poem, its containing form, its sounds, its entirety. We are both in control and not in control. Sometimes we seem to be guiding the poem, and then if we're lucky, if we can let go and if the time is ripe, the poem can seem to have a life apart from us, to come from somewhere beyond us, and to take the lead. I can't help thinking of Montaigne's conundrum. "When I am playing with my cat, how do I know she is not playing with me?" Dreams are also important. With them, as with poems, we appear to be both directing them and not directing them. We might not write on the dreams themselves, but they remind us of the power of our imaginative lives and of our fluid, creative selves. Last summer, I glimpsed a kingfisher in Toll's Meadow, a flash of blue and orange, and then I wondered if I'd dreamt it. Trying to write can seem like that, a flash of something that disappears before you can grasp it. Sometimes, though, it can be more like a different sighting, that of a white egret, which stays long enough to imprint you with its presence. The difficulty can be those poems that have to be got out of the way, like obstacles blocking a path before you can write something more successful. On the other hand, sometimes a poem you really grapple with and almost give up on can finally work out. Ending a poem can be tough, and if the ending isn't right, that's one of the hardest things, because usually, for me at least, it comes out of the process of writing as the culmination of the poem. But the ending has occasionally surprised me by coming first, like the cart before the horse. You could say, Rahila, there are no poetry rules that are not made to be broken. So much is possible, you see, if the need to write is there, along with the openness to finding those poems that have to be written. Ted Hughes, contemplating children's poetry competitions, wondered why more of these talented children didn't go on to become well-known poets. He concluded that there must be the need to write, as well as the talent, and he maintained, "Some form of compulsion seems to be far more important in the making of a writer than innate literary gifts. Thus, a great poet emerges where the greatest talent meets the greatest need, or the right psychological climate." Perfection is hard to achieve in any sphere. The process and the daring can be what matter most. Writing poetry is a risky enterprise, comparable to falling in love. There's that sense of vulnerability and uncertainty as to the outcome. But don't despair. Faith is needed, Rahila, and the confidence that you have something to offer, or that you will eventually at least make a breakthrough. The depth of communication involved in poetry is in itself a risk. Perhaps you won't be heard, understood. Sometimes you find that the poem you've worked out on the page isn't in the end there in the way it seemed to have been at the back of your head. It's as if something has been lost in translation. Yet a poem that works can induce for writers and for readers a feeling almost of déjà vu, of recognition, as if a veil has been torn away. Rilke had the desire, through poetry, to bind himself more firmly to reality. As with being in love with any aspect of life, writing poems can go a long way towards anchoring us in the world. The rhythms of writing are not as predictable as the seasons in Toll's Meadow, and often I wonder where the next poem is coming from. Against the despair, there's the hope that another poem will take me further, and that there's more ground to be covered. The joy of unmapped terrain. It seems to me, Rahila, that you have plenty to say and remarkable ways of saying it, and I wish you all the very best for your adventures in poetry. Writing a poem, an attempt to speak to another, to make a bridge to the other with the expressive music of language. The other, who is always finally unknowable, whether human being or dog. Back to dog walking, and that relationship the short story writer Lydia Davis tries to penetrate. Of course, my dog does not know I am human. He sees me as dog, though I do not leap up at a fence.